I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, whether it's a little chuckle or a big belly laugh, the power of humor can be truly amazing. Why does laughter feel so great? And how does humor help us connect with each other?
There's different kinds of laughter. There's laughter which is spontaneous, and that's what animals show. There's also that kind of where we're trying to say, yeah, I'm listening to you, I'm still with you, I'm still there. And we use that second laughter quite a lot.
And later, what can leaders and CEOs learn from studying improv?
Presentations up there with bereavement and death. People are more scared of public speaking than those. You know, wow. It's number one, two, or three out of those. Because in nature, the only time you're faced with a bunch of eyes staring at you is when you're the prey and the predators are about to eat you.
Actor and comedian Neil Malarkey on Being Funny. How humor and improv can help us navigate those unscripted moments in our lives. That's all coming up on KCRW's Life Examined. Frequently on this program, we've explored ways of finding joy and happiness, perhaps by adopting new habits and rituals, or looking to nature. But there's another component that plays a key role in our daily well-being, and that's humor. A good laugh relaxes us, eases anxiety and our oxygen intake, and laughing helps the release of endorphins, our body's natural painkillers. It's been recorded that people who have a good sense of humor live longer. Humor helps to maintain perspective and reminds us that we're not perfect and/or infallible. As a teenager, Neil Malarkey became acutely aware of the power of humor. Inspired by the likes of Monty Python, Mike Myers, and Chicago's Second City Theater, Malarkey turned his love for comedy, and especially improv, into his full-time passion and career. And it turns out that his improv skills had a broader use. In his book, In the Moment, Malarkey talks about how listening, communication, and adaptability are as fundamental to improv as they are in the world of management and leadership. And while not every CEO needs to be a comedian, a little levity in the workplace creates a fun atmosphere and promotes collaboration and goodwill. Neil Malarkey is a writer, comedian, and author of In the Moment, Build Your Confidence, Creativity, and Communication at Work. And he joins us now. Neil, welcome.
Thank you. And Malarkey is my real name. I'll talk more about that in a moment.
Well, I guess the name chooses the career or the career chooses the name, right? So we can plow further into that. I'd love to start. Well, maybe it'll take us there immediately. I mean, what drew you to the world of comedy and humor?
I realized when I was a teenager that comedy had power. You could make friends. You could calm moments. And humor, if used well, I still think is a great way to create connection, to give perspective. But I suppose the engine to become a professional comedian was I was in the school plays when I was about 16. At that point, I was thinking of being a doctor. So in the UK, you have to choose three or now four A-levels at that stage. You study for 2 years, take exams before you then leave school, perhaps go to tertiary education. I chose physics, maths, chemistry, with a view to being a doctor. And then I was in the school play. My head was turned. I found you could get laughs. I found that was rather addictive. Mm. I behaved very badly. When you're in a play, you should let the person who's speaking be seen, probably. But if you found a comedy soda siphon on the other side of the stage, you can start playing with it and get lots of laughs, taking the focus. And this was my crime. So I think we did three performances. And I had a fake moustache. And I played with the soda siphon, got a big laugh first night, got a big laugh second night. Third night, I did the same thing. And my comedy moustache started getting droopy because I'd done the soda siphon straight into my own face. So that's what I thought. This is what I want to do, actually. And I was also moving away from natural sciences. I then went to study social science and economics at university, but I specifically wanted to go to Cambridge University because it had the footlights, the Cambridge footlights, which at that stage had spawned many people that your listeners of a certain age may remember, Monty Python, Peter Cook. Since then, it's produced many people like Hugh Laurie, Stephen Fry, Emma Thompson, Olivia Colman, Sacha Baron Cohen. Mm. So it's a comedy group because you can't actually study drama unless you're doing it as a Bachelor of Education at Cambridge University. So I did economics, social science, or lots of other people were studying all sorts of things. But the Footlights was this finishing school, I suppose, or starting school, maybe, for people who wanted to write sketches. And I got into the footlights. I got to be on the committee. Then I got to be president my last year. And that was when my father, himself a chemical engineer, who'd always said, study what you want. Don't just study what leads to a job. And I'd already gone off track by studying social sciences. And then he says, do you want to be a performer? I said, yeah, this is what I want to do. And I was obviously worrying because it's not a very secure job. But the Comedy Store Players, which I started with Mike Myers in 1985, is still going strong. We are in the Guinness World of Records, and next year will be our 40th anniversary.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this somewhat abstract question then. As somebody who has spent their life exploring humor and as a performer, what is the role of humor in human society and culture? Why do we enact it? Why do we love it? Why do we use it? I'd love just some thoughts on that.
Well, it's a question that I have wondered, because it is a strange thing, especially to be an individual stand-up, which I'm not, have tried a few times, but one person in front of a whole room demanding their attention and their laughs, not just their attention. Why is that? But that's a separate thing from laughter, humor in daily life, I think.
Yeah.
What is it, especially in the personal ads where people would say GSOH was required, not just to be solvent. If you're looking for a partner, good sense of humor.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why do we want that? What is it that we see as somebody who can make us laugh or laugh with us seems to be somebody we'd want to seek out? And I looked at this and I wondered, do animals have laughter? And I just concluded they didn't. And humor and humanity were, you know, part of the same deal. And of course, years later, I found that animals do laugh. In my book, I mentioned the rats have little laughter moments. You can hear a soundtrack that UCL here, University College London, has looked at the neuroscience of laughter. But I think comedy, laughter, when used correctly, shall we say, is a unifying force. And for my book, I found that there's things like affiliative humor and disaffiliative. Disaffiliative is, look at that person, they're not in our group, they're different from us, let's laugh at them. For me, that isn't humor, that's bullying. That's using laughter as a machete. Humor that brings us together, affiliative humor, could be broken down into things that where we realize we have something in common, where we realize we're not perfect, where we realize that we're humans and our fallibility and our frailty are shared. We can look at perspective, and I often sort of thought about this and thought about humor brings us together. Humor sheds light, because the best humor, like Frasier, I'm thinking of now, we see that not everyone sees the world as well as they should. We can laugh at those characters who can't see beyond their own nose.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met a professor of psychology at London Business School, where I've worked. And he said that, and he said, I'm a Darwinian. I said, all right, that means you're tooth and claw. He said, no. It's actually, we seek out those with a sense of humor because in times gone by, the leader who could emerge in a tribe or a group was the one who created the facility and the environment for collaboration. Shall we say, broadly speaking, sharing security and food.
Mm-hmm.
Let's make a camp. And the one who could create harmony and collaboration was the one that it would emerge, I suppose. Not just the biggest person, the toughest warrior. And so he was saying humor as an affiliative thing, as something that brings us together. And I do think we are attracted to those in every way who can make us laugh. But also we like people who can laugh with us. And I do observe a lot of humor, and Sophie Scott, I mentioned her before, she looks, there's different kinds of laughter. There's laughter which is spontaneous, and that's what animals show. There's also that kind of where we're trying to say, yeah, I'm listening to you, I'm still with you, I'm still there. And we use that second laughter quite a lot. It's not that laughter rings hollow, but we think, actually, I better just show that I'm still in the gang with you. And there are times when you can see it's not spontaneous. But I think humor brings us together. Humor makes us see things from a different perspective, and we understand, oh, right, none of us is perfect. And that fallibility is actually joyous. Brené Brown, who talks a lot about vulnerability, to me, humor is accepting our vulnerability, enjoying one another's fallibility. And of course, I think we love the people we love, not for their perfection, but for their imperfection. And there's another quote from Robert McKee, that's right, the sort of guru of story. And he was talking about humorous films versus not humorous films. And he said, comedians tend to be idealists who are disappointed. They're often thought to be as cynics. It's pointing out what's wrong with the world. But he was saying, from his framing, they're idealists who keep spotting how their ideals haven't been fulfilled. I don't know if that's true, because, you know, many of the comedians we love are the ones who point out where fact doesn't quite match the fiction.
Yes.
The headline says this, and actually the way we behave is this. I promise to do this, and actually in reality I fail to do that.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting what an attractive quality it is in someone. I just had this memory of being in high school. I was kind of a tall jock thinking I could, you know, find a girlfriend if I wanted one. I had very little luck, by the way. But I had a friend who was quite short, whose voice hadn't dropped yet, who was not the most attractive of guys, I would say. But he was so funny. He dated the most beautiful women I had ever seen in my life. We always thought, what is going on with you? But it was his humor. It was his intelligence. It was just like this magnet that brought people to him. And I always thought, like, what is the power of that? Because I think we really do feel this attraction towards people, not just romantically, but also with our friends. They're the people who we end up getting along with, or those that we laugh with. But it was an anecdote that always kind of stayed with me when I thought about just what we're talking about here, which is the wonder and power of humor.
Absolutely. Clive James, an Australian writer who spent much time in the UK, said, sense of humor, or humor, is intelligence dancing.
Yeah.
And we do look for those who can see deeper. Yes, there's humor of the banana skin, the silly humor, but there's also a sense of intelligence behind that. But also the satirical comment, the moment where you think, ah, yes, of course, that is true, but I hadn't thought of it that way. That does belie some sense of, ah, there is a reflective nature there. They can see things beyond the facts, beyond the obvious. And dare I say, those beautiful women, wouldn't they just want somebody to make them laugh? I mean, when we laugh, there's all sorts of things going on in our body. There's feel-good hormones and stuff. And wouldn't you like to be associated with that? And I'm sure you were incredibly beautiful and still are.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
But actually, there's only so much beauty I can take. If somebody makes me smile and laugh, then I know I'll feel better. You know, there's all sorts of physiological consequences of laughing.
Yeah. And can you say a little bit about that? Like, what's released in the body when we laugh? I found that really interesting.
Well, there's so much. You know, a big belly laugh is as good as going rowing. It helps you when you just things like, we all have moments of what's called gallows humor. Mm-hmm. Gallows humor, which is doctors and others who are in really fraught occupations, and we need to laugh. It's black humor, dark humor that we wouldn't necessarily allow to be talked about outside our in-group, but we know we need it there. We know we need it there. So here, I'm just looking at my book. Here we are. The Mayo Clinic in 2021 said that laughter is good for your health, both in the short and the long term. Lord Byron said, always laugh when you can. It is cheap medicine. Mm. So the Mayo Clinic said that laughter relieves stress, stimulates organs, increases the release of endorphins, which are sort of natural painkillers. Your blood pressure rises when you laugh, then dips below. So that sort of gets your heart growing stronger. A good belly laugh relieves muscle tension, increases oxygen intake. And this all together enhances your immune system, relieving pain and improving self-esteem. And there's a book that I mentioned, Marjorie Hutter Silver from Harvard Medical School, talked about people who lived past 100. what was the common thread? And she found it was a good sense of humour. She talked about it as internal jogging. And there's a wonderful thing called laughter yoga. Have you heard about this?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
It's just great. They're not even telling jokes, because jokes, who knows, you don't get the joke, you may feel offended by the joke, but they just sit and laugh. it's contagious, and that's what's so wonderful about it. There's 110 countries now with laughter yoga. They just laugh, and together that becomes contagious, becomes viral. And apparently a sense of humour lowers mortality rates, especially for women, according to a study in the Scientific American in 2016. So there were Norwegian researchers who investigated 54,000 people over 15 years. Now, I think there is a cognitive component of humour, which, as I mentioned before, can mitigate against conflict. If we can laugh together, we probably won't be angry with each other. Cortisol is a stress hormone. Perhaps it suppresses, laughter will suppress that. And I think that the first laughter we have tends to be with our family, with the person who is caring for us, a parent or whoever. And that immediate connection that a child has, they laugh before they perhaps know why they're laughing, peekaboo and other things. And for me, laughter is actually physiological, cognitive, emotional. So it seems bizarre that we would frown upon it in organizations. Somehow it seems frivolous. And I do understand that if you're laughing, you might not be doing your job. But all the research tells us that when you laugh together, you probably do your job better. There's a sense of collaborative endeavor. There's a sense of relieving stress. There's a sense of we're able to entertain left field ideas in a moment of laughter. And the number of people, I think it was David Abbott, a great advertising guru, said, you know when it's a good idea, when it kind of makes you laugh. You go, oh, of course, why not? That's a great slogan. That's a great idea to present our notion in that way. We just know this is true. We know it to be true. And I suppose my journey from teaching improv to people in organizations was, I thought, improv is about listening, accepting difference, coping with ambiguity, uncertainty. And then at the end of a day, I've done my best to give people the tools, and somebody says, you know, we've had such a laugh with you today, and we don't do that normally. And I'm thinking, yes, of course, I came from the world of comedy. I stepped into the world of management training, leadership development. And then actually, perhaps the greatest tool I have is bringing that together, because I'm not the one alone being funny. All I bring out is say, look at improv. If we listen, accept the other person's idea and add to it, we can laugh together and be the engine of the laughter. I so love it when the quieter person, the not so senior person, is the one who, because they're following the protocol I give them, makes us all laugh. And the number of times people say to me, you know what, we saw something in her, in him that day, and she's flowered, she's flourished. We are actually, she's doing the pitches now, and we never would have thought of her in that way. That to me is a win. And so that's why I did write a whole book about a chapter about humor, because I felt it was necessary. Although people think I teach people how to make you laugh, and that's not the primary aim of what I do, it's a beautiful and almost essential part of what I teach, which is, if we can laugh together, what else can we achieve together?
Talk a little bit more about the word improv, which has been shorthand for improvisation. But I'll let you kind of sit with that word and talk about what it is. Because when we think about, say, an improv troupe, it's where we see things evolve organically and magically and happening in the moment. And I think from the outsider's perspective, it's, of course, incredibly entertaining, but it also looks horrifying to be a part of, right? The idea of, like, I would be thrown in there and suddenly being forced to create things on the fly seems like such a vulnerable and creative process that you know, not everybody wants to try out, but I know that for you, there's real value behind this exercise. But I also want to make sure I'm describing it correctly, so I'll hand it over to you and let you have at it.
Thank you. I will. And you'd be a great improviser because you're a good listener. And that is the turnaround. What? Improv is listening? Yes, it is. Actually, it's not standing center stage and saying, look at me, aren't I funny? And this is the journey I take people on. They think, I'm going to force you to get on stage on your own, be funny now. I can't imagine anything worse than that.
Yeah.
As I said, stand-up is not what I do. And you may not know that this form of improv, that's the word I use, improv. Improvisation we do all the time. We improvise, we muddle through, we extemporize. But improv is an art form. It's a discipline. Actually, I wrote about this and I thought, can I say this? And I went with it. It's almost like a martial art. There is a discipline over and above the individual. But for those listeners who aren't familiar with this is a type of theatre. The audience gives suggestions and the actors take the suggestion and then co-create theatre. A song, a sketch, a scene, a story. And this started with a social worker in the 1920s in Chicago. She wasn't creating theatre. She was helping children. Inner city children, deprived children, perhaps they were not native speakers. She said, I wasn't creating exercises. I was solving a problem. How to bring out these children, bring out their confidence in their communication skills. And it was her son who said, wow, these exercises could work as a form of theatre in their own right. So by 1959, he'd created Second City. And I'd heard of Second City because I liked a movie called The Blues Brothers, traced it back to Saturday Night Live, traced it back to Second City, John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd. So when I met Mike Myers, who'd come from Second City, Canada, he told me that actually a lot of the work is generated through improv, but certainly the ethos, the mindset of improv is essential to that work. And essential to that is listening, creating the psychological safety of whatever you say, I will go with you. Treat what she says, he says, your fellow player, as an offer to build upon. And Del Close, one of the gurus of this work, in a way was helping you to think, Jonathan, when I have to stand on stage on my own, that isn't it. He said, don't try and build a whole scene on your own. Just bring a brick and together we will build a cathedral. That is the essence of the co-creation. There are all sorts of other things, which is about it's okay not to be perfect. In fact, every improv scene is an exercise in imperfection. Mm-hmm. But we try and create scenes. We're not doing stand-up. It's one person listening to another, often two, maybe more on stage. And the ethos which I teach, which I think applies to communication, leadership, teamwork, which is how can I build on what you said? And actually, this is the thing which somebody said, Financial Times writer said, this is the radical thing about your book. Improv, you said, is about making the other person look good. Where will that lead us? Of course it is. Now, we all do improv slightly differently, but we all have this ethos of listen to what she's saying, build on what he's given, treat it as an offer, yes, and. And so what's interesting about that, if you stick to the discipline, humour follows. And there's plenty of improv, by the way, which isn't setting out to be humorous. They create theatre in the moment and it's wonderful. But often humour does come and many comedy types are drawn to it. Stand-ups sometimes not so comfortable because they're not used to working with others and they're not used to having periods of not laughter. Building the scene. We always try and establish who we are, what we're doing, where we are, and something about the scene, that something's at stake. So Mike Myers taught me this. He came to see the show I mentioned, the ex-Cambridge Footlights show, because he'd heard of Monty Python and was sitting there. And I said, who are you? He said, I've come from Canada, from Second City. And Second City, and this is the place I admire because I loved North American humour. And he said, actually, the ethos, it's built upon improv, not just sketches that are written and rehearsed. So improv, that's why I separate it from improvisation, which is something you do daily and can be a bit scary when we muddle through and so forth. But actually, improv is where you set out to go on stage with others to create theatre that has no script, which is different from failing to learn your lines. And in my book, I point out there are times you want improv skills and there are times you want something else.
Yeah.
So, for example, today we knew what time we had to be here. We knew we'd got the hardware, the software It was organized. You knew roughly how to spell my name. I was agreed to come on time. So there was enough structure such that then we can improvise the games. Same with the Comedy Store players with whom I improvise. We start at 7:30. We finish at 9:30. The Comedy Store has sold tickets. There's security, insurance, food. But then when we are on stage, we are totally in the moment improvising. So there are guide rails, if you like, and they're very simple. Quite often there's a game we play based on emotions, one on film and theatre styles. But then there's sufficient structure to then be spontaneous. Mm. And one of my abiding lessons I picked up from Ashridge Management College, which is down the road from here, now part of HULT, EF, a global education provider, and kind of looking at leadership as an improv discipline, they were talking about minimal structure, maximum autonomy. So there is structure, but within that, there's autonomy for the team to find their own story. So that's, if you like, improv, this mindset which has echoes with improvised music and even improvised art, Jackson Pollock, I suppose. Somebody once said that improv is the 20th century American art form. Hmm. And I wouldn't necessarily dispute that, but the roots go deeper perhaps into Commedia dell'arte, where they had stock characters, the foolish captain who was a coward, army captain, the lovers, the wise servant, etc. And then the stock characters led to sort of narratives. But actually, it's because of Second City and those people that created that idea. We can get on stage and do a 2-hour show with no script. And the ethos they created was summarized in yes and. Yes, I hear what you say, and I build on that. Mm-hmm. They spent many times, there was the committee and the St. Louis players before Second City emerged who were thinking drama equals conflict. I've got to deny your reality. But actually, they found that there was a much more fruitful way of creating theatre. They didn't lack drama if they said yes and. That is the thing I'm still learning, is how do we apply yes and on stage and how do we apply yes and in life?
If you're just joining us here on KCRW's Life Examined, my guest this hour is Neil Malarkey. And we're discussing the history and the role of humor in our world and our culture. And we'll continue with that conversation in part two after this short break. And a reminder that you can connect with me directly on Instagram. I'm at Jonathan W. Bastian. Ask me questions about the show. Tell me what you like, what you don't like. You can also connect with us on Facebook. There's a link to that at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. And a quick reminder, the Midweek Reset drops every Wednesday in your podcast feed. We'll be back with Neil Malarkey for part two of our conversation on Life Examined after this break. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW, and Neil Malarkey, actor, comedian, and author of In the Moment, Build Your Confidence, Creativity, and Communication at Work. We've been talking about ways in which humor and using improv can be translated into the workplace, and how learning to improvise is great for self-confidence, communication, and creativity. As we rejoin the conversation, I talk with Malarkey about the role of listening in improv and in the workplace, and ask about the key ingredients of a good speech, whether it's an office presentation or as a best man at a wedding. Let's jump back in.
I'm really struck just by the concept that improv begins by listening, and because that's a topic that I think so much about, which is when I think about my own journey as somebody on the radio, for example, it's more or less been a journey into listening and actually taking my questions and throwing them off the table and being able to sit in a place of receptivity. And I think I remember hearing this from Neil Conan, who was a great host at NPR, and he heard it from something else. He said, questions don't arise by writing down what you think the next question is. They arise by just listening to what's arising in the moment. And to me, like, to be able to really listen also means being really calm. And when we're calm, we're listening better. And we're open to reacting in a way that feels more kind of organic and fluent. And I hear a lot of echoes in what you're talking about here. And very similarly, I remember sitting with a CEO of this big liquor company, and we were just, I don't even know how we were in conversation. And he said, "What do you do?" I said, "Well, I mostly listen." And I said, "What do you do?" And he goes, "Oh, I mostly just listen all day long." And I was like, "Oh, we have similar jobs?" I found that to be really fascinating, because we think of as leaders as kind of just making decisions and you know, having to just, you know, sign their name everywhere and move ahead with plans. But I think there is something deeper going on here that maybe both you and I are getting at.
Absolutely. Rule one of improv is listen. And that, when people have understood that, they think, oh, right, I can be relaxed in the moment. I don't have to write a script. I don't have to worry about what I'm going to say. I just have to build on what she said. And if she's doing the same for me, then together we co-create something wonderful. So I talk about listening with intent. People talk about active listening, and I'm talking, I don't know if I made up the word, intentive listening, which is I'm intending specifically to use something you said or some concept or even sometimes the energy with which you say something or don't say something that you pause. So listening with intent. And there are lots of definitions of listening, which aren't really listening, you know, waiting for your turn to speak rather than taking on board what the other person said.
Yeah.
So one of my friends is a coach, psychologist, who works with executive teams. He says they're not so much listening as reloading. Hmm. So you're kind of just waiting for your turn to jump in. You haven't heard what's been said. And that's the ethos of improv, is actually, what does my character learn in this scene? How is she altered by what transpires in this moment? So there's that sense of learning. Even a moment is to be learned, to learn. And interestingly, I bet that CEO was excellent, because they listened. And this is when I've got a 5-point acronym for improv, which I now apply to life beyond the stage. And the first one is listen. Listen to your fellow player, but then in real life, listen to your customers, listen to your suppliers, listen to your stakeholders, listen to your employees. And then another one, listen to your subconscious sometimes, because it could be telling you something. And one day I did a coaching course at Ashridge, again, near London. We looked at all sorts of different styles of coaching, and one was Gestalt. Gestalt. And they talked about the figural and the ground. So actually, in the Gestalt relationship with your coachee, you can say things like, "That's making me feel uneasy," or "I'm noticing you keep pausing when you say Jonathan," or "You keep saying cheese," or something. And it doesn't have to be clever or diagnostic. It's just noticing one's own reaction, which to me is quite interesting, because there are some therapeutic interventions where you should be not giving anything of yourself, but noticing that there's plenty of information from simply listening. And that CEO was thinking, yeah, actually, if I was just broadcasting all day, what would I miss? Yes, there are times you have to broadcast, but that listening of being perhaps changed by what you hear. And actually, one of the things people say about improv is it's not so much acting as reacting. And our ethos is follow the follower, which is I'm not writing a script. I'm just improving your script or adding to your story to move it forward. And if you're doing the same to me, actually, at some point we forget who started it. We forget whose idea it was. And because we both own it. So this sense of listening with intent, and actually it means drowning out your own inner script or anything that gets in the way. And Keith Johnson, who's one of the gurus of improv, he said, when you get to that moment of Zen, of having nothing in your brain, in your mind, you know, that's perfect. And it takes spiritual insight many, many years to actually empty your brain. But with improvisers, we get there eventually, because actually what I find is when newbie improv practitioners, or even people I'm teaching in a corporate situation, when they're not sure what to say, it's not because they don't know what to say. it's because their mind is full of lots of things to say, mm-hmm. and they don't know which one to say. Whereas the improviser says, what you just said, I'll take that and move it forward. I don't know where it's going to go, but I trust the process that it'll work somewhere. We'll find a story and a reason why. And they haven't thought about mentally ticking off which things might not work, because they're just going, you said cheese. I'll say cheese times three. Yes, the biggest cheese in the world. Or I'm terrified of cheese. Or cheese? You've heard the secret of cheese. You make a choice. And this is a lot about improv is choice. There's some reason why cheese today is vital. Because you said cheese, I'm going to listen to that. I'm not thinking, how do I feel about cheese? What's my thoughts about cheese? What are my opinions about cheese? I'm going to say, that's the offer, and I'm going to build that and explore why specifically today cheese has been given to us by the gods of improv.
And just that last piece there, it reminds me that what gets in the way of so much kind of free-flowing, vulnerable communication is this constant self-judging filter in how we make decisions of the things we say, right? It's like you said, the newbie comes in and saying like, oh, it could be this, 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 or this, where eventually I would think the more practiced improv actor just goes. The thing comes out, yeah. Right? And I think but that's kind of where we all want to get to eventually, isn't it?
I don't know. Keith Johnston, I mentioned him a moment ago. He ended up in Calgary, recently passed one of the gurus. He said, you become a good improv performer when you let go of the fear of being seen as mad, bad, or wrong. Hmm. You're celebrating cheese as the best thing ever. Seems a bit weird, but of course, it's an abductive reasoning, which I found. The reason we look for deductive reasons was, does it work? I need to know why it worked. Whereas we in improv saying, we don't know why it worked, but it just seemed to be right to say cheese at that moment. In hindsight, yes, of course, that's the whole reason why the edifice crumbled, or we defeated the dragon or found the treasure. So I would say, yes, it's a great place to be. On the other hand, none of my improv colleagues would I want them to be CEO of a liquor company. So my mission in life, I think, is to say to those of you who have real jobs, proper jobs and responsibility, not like we ne'er-do-well boulevardiers in the improv theatre, if you could borrow a little bit of our stuff, wouldn't that be great? You'd feel more creative and more collaborative. You'd be a better leader. You'd feel more confident to stepping up into leadership positions. Or actually, at this moment in time, and this is the improv thing as well, sometimes I'm leading, sometimes I'm in the backing. And there's a guy called Frank J. Barrett, who's a business professor and also jazz musician, who wrote a book called Say Yes to the Mess, which is sometimes it's a bit of a mess. But if you say yes to it, something will emerge. Rather than trying to solve it too quickly, and this again, I'm sure with coaching and other therapeutic interventions, don't come in with a solution too early. Mm-hmm. But he talks about comping. So sometimes leadership is comping, which is a sort of idiom talking about accompanying. If you're in a music group, sometimes you're doing the solo, but sometimes you're keeping the rhythm going.
Yeah.
And the best teams alternate those. Sometimes I'm running with the ball. Sometimes I'm just making space for you to run. Sometimes I'm doing the rhythm. Sometimes I'm leading the solo. And that almost moment by moment changes. So yes, it is a great place to be. And on stage, I feel in flow. It's just wonderful. However, it's great to get laughs as well. So the psychology professor I mentioned, Nigel Nixon from London Business School, who talked about laughter being an element of something that shows we can collaborate and share. He said he looked at some of the exercises they're doing. He said, actually, there's an element of competition and an element of collaboration. Actually, it isn't all. And I said, yeah, you're right, actually, is we push each other to greater heights. And the joy of being an improv performer is you are both totally an individual, but totally part of a team. And that's what I love about it, is everyone does it slightly differently. We're following yes and, but I can be myself. I can say what I like, actually, but I know that my team will support me and they know I will support them. So that's a great place to be. Mm-hmm. The fact is, though, on a Tuesday morning, if I'm importing cars, boxes, delivering stuff, making sure things get done, I have to worry about supply chain and logistics. I can't be too much in that zone. I have to know, is this an improv moment or is this something else? I haven't called, well, I don't know what that is, a non-improv moment, which is planning, strategy, structure, logistics. I need to get that right. I can't just say, oh man, I'm improvising, you know, we'll get your stuff to you in 3 weeks' time. So quite often, my job is to say to people, notice when it's a moment of improv, which requires uncertainty, ambiguity, and embracing novelty. And notice when you have expertise, which you can bring to the table and plan and work it out ahead of time, because you can't get that right with these improv skills. But equally, don't bring your scripted, structured brain to that moment when you really need to listen to that person, mm-hmm. when he or she needs you to listen. And that could be one of your team. It could be your supplier. It could be your customer. It could be your family member. And that's where I talk about the idea of winging it. You know that phrase, winging it?
Yeah.
So actually, people think it sounds like you're gliding beautifully with wings. But actually, it's the opposite in a way. It started in the theatre where somebody hadn't learned their lines. So they were in the scripted world. They had to learn their lines. They'd failed so to do. They'd have to go over to the wings of the theatre, the side of the stage. What's my line? What's my line? So they're in a state of panic, of non-creativity. There's only one version of the truth. There's one line. You know, the words need to be right. So they're actually deeply uncreative and lacking in confidence and unrelaxed. And so when you do need to learn your script, learn it, as it were. When you stick to a plan, have a plan. When you, especially with presentations. I've seen presentations where they think, oh, I'll just talk. They waffle. They go on too long. They don't make their point. So I teach presentation, which means rehearse, get it down, know where you're starting, know when you're finishing, stick to time, make your point, and then the Q&A can be the improv bit where you do listen and react differently. And I think in life we get those two mixed up. And there's a guy called Ronald Heifetz, Heifetz and Minsky from Harvard Business School, who talked about different challenges in life or in business and in life, I dare say, which is sometimes you face with a problem and there's a solution. You've been there before. You can talk it out. There's a rational solution. It's called a technical challenge. Okay, we've been here before. We can look at this, apply our knowledge and a solution. Then there's what he calls an adaptive challenge. This is novel. We haven't been here before. Right, we can't just apply the old script. We have to live with uncertainty. We have to kind of say yes to the mess as we delve into possibilities and try stuff out and prototype and pilot. And he says the mistake is trying to bring technical mindset to an adaptive challenge. And I would say vice versa as well. That's why I don't want my improv colleagues to be running anything, basically. We can hardly run ourselves. So that's kind of what I'm saying. And there are many books out there and improvisers who say improv will change everything. You just do yes and you'll be happy. And I say, well, actually, did you notice that when you do a show, you do turn up on time? You do respect the boundaries of the audience's structure, you know, that they've paid, they want to be entertained. You stick to time. You have an interval. You tend to stay on the stage. You know who's in the team. There may be a running order of which games or whatever. So again, that dynamic of structure versus spontaneity.
Well, let's talk about kind of an example that just seems to freak most people out. I think it always shows up on lists like, what are you most scared of? And it's like public speaking, right? Yes. Giving the presentation. Or the one that I see a lot of is like, you've been asked to give like the best man speech at a wedding, right? And it's, I've just been to so many weddings and I've seen these things either be these incredible flops or an amazing success. And I always feel so bad for those that are forced to go up there, actually in a lot of situations, because we're not taught how to do this stuff, you know?
No.
We pick it up a little bit by osmosis and we watch, maybe we can watch a YouTube video, but like we are not taught how to present effectively. And I think I want to ask you about that, but specifically how one learns to bring humor into these more scripted moments, because I think we all have to encounter these, or most of us do. A lot of us will avoid them forever, but how do we begin to approach something like that presentation or that speech with some of the principles around humor that you would suggest?
Well, there's a comedian and author in the UK called Marcus Brigstock, and his advice to anybody doing a best man or best woman speech was, start by saying how great they are, the couple. Aren't they great? I love my friend. And then he says you can get away with anything. The worst kind is where you try and do an off-color joke about your friend about something that puts him in a bad light or her in a bad light.
Yeah,
I don't think that's helpful. And so my first rule of humor is don't do jokes. Don't do jokes. You know, frankly, beware the joke. It's so much better not to try humor than to try humor and fail. Again, one of some research I found in my book is the leader who does gags and jokes that fail is actually worse, gets, you know, the audience, his team, thinks less of him or her than if they hadn't even tried. My experience is people who do ba-da-ba-da-ba-ding jokes in those kind of environments will fail. I was told about a CEO who came on to the Rocky theme wearing, you know, a robe, boxing gloves and stuff.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun. And then proceeded to go to a lectern and give an ordinary CEO speech. Uh-huh. It was kind of, why did you do that? Just be authentic to who you are. So my best advice on humor is don't do jokes. But if you want a humor, then it's okay if you have humor. Have a smile. Try and find a few stories where you're the one who didn't come out so well. You looked a bit naff, I would say, in English. Or you just kind of, uh-oh, wasn't I dumb to do that? Wasn't I stupid to do that? So your vulnerability is, wasn't I silly? So if you do feel you have to have humor, best man speeches are really interesting because often when I'm helping people with presentations and I say, you've got this at the conference or to your team, whatever, do you rehearse? No, I never rehearse. Because they think, I do my job. Why do I need to rehearse stuff that I talk about all the time? Because presentation is different from normal discourse. Presentation, and I say to people, you're scared, as you say, it's up there with bereavement and death. People are more scared of public speaking than those. You know, wow. It's number one, two, or three out of those.
Right.
Because in nature, the only time you're faced with a bunch of eyes staring at you is when you're the prey and the predators are about to eat you.
Oh, funny.
You're the gazelle and the lion's about. It's, of course, it's scary. It should be scary. It's not natural. And that's why I wonder, like, why people like me, why do we want to stand up in front of a room full of strangers? And I'll tell you, the drug, it's addictive. Getting laughs from those people, you've kind of won, if you like, but it's a complicit victory. We've all won. Anyway, so first of all, I say to him, have you ever done a best man, best woman speech? Oh, yes. Did you rehearse for that? I rehearsed like heck. I rehearsed so much you wouldn't believe. I said, okay. And did it go well? It went really well. People still talk about it. Okay. So just be minded that the rehearsal probably helped. Did you have somebody help you? Yeah, I did. Okay. Did you have somebody sit in with you? Yeah. Okay. So these are all the things I would say in real life presentation. Start with voice memo. So actually, I'm recording this on voice memo. And I'll send it to you later, which is the iPhone voice recording. It's voice recorder on Android. So say to your phone a few things you might say, topics, stories, figures, say a few things. And then your brain will start thinking about the presentation. And maybe something funny to you will come to you or not, or just something apposite. Just in the same way that I'm driving, I'm having a shower. Suddenly that word, that name I was trying to think of comes to me. My undermind, it's called. Which is a brilliant guy called Guy Claxton, the UK academic. He wrote Harebrained Tortoise Mind, which is sometimes the tortoise, the slow tortoise, is the more creative one, the one who is not even thinking about stuff. And suddenly an idea comes to you when you least expect it, when you're driving or cooking. And so say a few words into your voice memo. It means you're already thinking about the oral, not the written. You are then getting your undermind to think of ideas without even thinking. And then when you come back to listen to what you've said, oh, right, write down a few ideas. And then this is what I say. Write down a few bullet points you've already got from voice memo or elsewhere. Then just say the speech. How go? You think, I'm nowhere near ready. Speak it out loud. Wow, I've got a few ideas. Maybe I'm 50% of the way there. Actually, I need a number there. If it's a business speech, I need a number there. I need a case study there. I need a good beginning, a good end. So I always say, write your beginning almost the last thing you do, because stand-up comedians tend to have their best joke at the beginning and their second best joke at the end. So beginnings and ends are good. So those are the things. Get get talking. And it's interesting, in the UK now, there are some schools that are giving real priority to what's called oracy, as in oral, as opposed to literacy, because yeah. everything we do, there's an oral element. Job interviews. I know AI will get us so far when we were recruiting or when we're applying for a job. But at some point, you may have to have a job interview. At some point, you're going to have to persuade people to join in your project, get buy-in, or assure your boss that your things are okay. You have to give a tiny presentation or a big presentation. So I would say humor, be careful with humor, because you could really upset people by doing enough. And you know, I've been there. I do things sometimes. I think, well, that's just a typical improv thing. But, oh, wait a minute. I mentioned something that was perhaps not so easy for the other person to hear. So be careful. My first rule is don't do jokes unless you're sure mm-hmm. they are going to work, because there's nothing worse than da-da-da-da punchline.
Right.
Silence. That's worse than if you were just talking normally. If you want a bit of humour, find some self-deprecating stories, but in a best man speech, try and think of a way to say, isn't he great? Isn't she marvellous? What a great friend they are. Because then the audience will love you for it. And I'm going to say as well, use that positivity in virtually any presentation you can give. I see so many inexperienced speakers, as they get on, they go, oh, well, they overrun, or the mic's not working. Why isn't the clicker? And they're getting angry. And immediately the audience is going, oh, right. If they're angry with that, they'll be angry with me. Mm-hmm. I went, and again, that sort of almost caveman, cavewoman thing, which is, this is somebody who seems aggressive. It's actually because they're nervous. So the best thing to do, if something goes wrong, says, oh, it's my fault. I must have, you know, it must be my magnetic field. I ruined the clicker. Oh, yes, stupid yeah. me. And you make yourself the butt. But if you do it with confidence and verve, then you'll look charming.
It's been great to be joined by Neil Malarkey, actor, writer, comedian, and author of In the Moment. Neil, thank you for the time. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I dare say, I'm feeling so relaxed. Your voice is so beautiful. It's so relaxing, and thank you. I can see why you were called to the job you are in.
Well, very kind. You've now won me over very well. So, well done. Thanks again for the time.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. Our producer is Andrea Brody. I'm your host, Jonathan Bastian, and this is Life Examined on your station, KCRW. We'll see you next week. Take care.